November, which says, here I am on the east coast of the United States, and I've had a high-gain antenna dead east, which will hit the center of Africa, and I want to talk to my friend in Africa. A beverage antenna could do it really well. If I aim that antenna to the east, and if I wanted to do radio astronomy at that HF frequency, and I allow the Earth to rotate, and the beverage antenna, let me drop it. The beverage antenna is making a nice pencil beam aimed to the east, a few degrees above the horizon. As the Earth rotates, that pencil beam is being swept through space as it passes by certain stars. If they happen to have emission at those frequencies, I could be doing radio astronomy with a beverage antenna. Now, modern-day radio astronomy, where you'd like to be able to resolve the individual stars, and we dream about resolving the individual planets around those stars and the other structures in space, usually radio astronomy these days is done at VHF, UHF, and higher frequencies because finite-sized antennas, horns and dishes and things like this, and phased arrays can give you enough directivity that gives you a steerable beam, that gives you a very sharp beam, and now you can resolve the individual details. But could you, with modern-day equipment, do radio astronomy at, let me pick a number, 3.4 megacycles with a beverage antenna? Absolutely. Question. Are there many stars out there emitting at that frequency? There, I'm not sure. Go ahead, John.
Matter with question. Okay. You have a beverage antenna connected to 1 milliwatt transmitter. And you have a germanium detector, the old style one, that draws 1 milliwatt of power from the speaker. How many receivers, no power supply connected, could receive in within the beam? So we're assuming that we have a directional beam, we're assuming that we have a all power possibly directed in one direction. How many receivers could receive the signal of the same kind?
In the way you posed the question, if I took you literally, the answer is zero. If I'm only radiating 1 milliwatt of power into a beverage antenna, and even though the beverage antenna might have 20 dB of gain, and you're saying the signal coming out of there acts like 20 milliwatts, it's not. You'd be amazed how many people have taken two 15 dB horns and put them together mouth to mouth and expected to get 30 dB of gain out of that structure. Put a milliwatt in and expect to get the 0 dBm in and expect to get 30 dBm coming out. No way in hell. Because every real transmitting antenna into every real receiving antenna and every real distance that you care about, I mean, very few of us are going to build a radio system at, let me pick a number, 3.5 megacycles, where we only want a range of 1 foot. We usually want a range of a bare minimum of a kilometer. In fact, the ARL defines real radio communication as apparatus that is capable of communicating over a distance of at least 1 kilometer. So 1 kilometer away from your 1 milliwatt power of your transmitter into a beverage antenna, a kilometer away because of free space laws being, I'll pick a number, 35 dB, that's let's make it 36 dB. 36 dB is a 4,000 to 1 ratio. Whatever power you transmit, a kilometer away, you're going to get 1/4,000th of that power with a similar antenna, if you know what I mean. Real free space laws has tremendous numbers of dBs of laws. On most real radio circuits at VHF frequencies, let me drop. At VHF frequencies at reasonable ranges, the signal loses around 90 decibels in the first mile. So real radio starts off with a pretty potent signal, X number of watts, and at the receiver end, you're going to receive X number of picowatts. 10 to the minus 12, 10 to the minus 15 of what was transmitted. Real ranges have a hell of a lot of loss. The good news is the signal gets there. The bad news, very little of it gets there. every receiver you have ever used, between the antenna terminal and the loudspeaker, there is 120 decibels of gain. Mother Nature loses that signal real fast. And the amount of loss is very predictable, inverse square law. Make believe your transmitter is a light bulb in the middle of a spherical room. Make believe the range between your transmission reception is the radius of the room. You know the area of the room, you can calculate that. Therefore, you know how many watts per square meter. Every antenna has a predictable amount of area in square meters. Therefore, you can predict X number of miles away exactly how many microwatts and picowatts is going to be picked up. So real radio transmissions have tremendous numbers of decibels between transmit power and reception power at a real range. And so, and the way you pose the problem, at a real range with a milliwatt of transmission, at any reasonable antenna a kilometer away, I'm going to get a picowatt of power, not a milliwatt of power, and that diode detector, your germanium diode, I don't care how perfect it is going to say, hey, Wes, you're wasting your time. Ain't nothing there as far as that diode is concerned. Now, you allow me to put a real RF amplifier with a low noise figure there, amplifying the signal before it goes into your germanium diode detector. Now, I...
Repeater, timeout.
As I said, you allow me to put a RF amplifier there, and now you've got a radio again. But real radio ranges have tremendous number of dBs of loss. Sometimes that's not made very clear. John,
yeah, but, I would like to say a few words. Dick, actually, beautifully answered the question. If we have a, let's say, dipole antenna, we have a transmitter of 1 milliwatt, and then we have a germanium receiver that is a suitable distance, a far field, a drawing half of a watt, or let's say 1/10 of the watt, we can calculate how many receivers will receive the signal, and there would be none more that could receive the signal. So your first statement is looks like misleading from the first hour of it. So by that token, percentage wide number of fluorescent lights would be also countable. And to actually...
A fluorescent light has a very specific threshold of energy required before you ionize the gas inside and it gives off any light. Every real receiving antenna listening to a real radio signal into a real radio that's got an RF amplifier, there is no limit. You allow the signal to get, you allow the range to get greater and greater in the case of Voyager, and the signal by inverse square law gets weaker and weaker. You use a bigger and bigger antenna, a higher and higher gain amplifier, a lower and lower noise figure on the front end of the parametric amplifier that they're using at Goldstone, and a more and more narrow signal being transmitted by Voyager, and you continue to get that signal from 8 billion miles away. Round trip radio time is 36 hours at the speed of light. Boy, is that a delay line. So, real radio, there is no limit. With real fluorescent bulbs, there's a very definite limit. You have to exceed a certain threshold or you get no light. Below that threshold, you don't ionize the gas. The fluorescent tube is a perfect open circuit. No energy gets absorbed.
I got confused. Is 1 milliwatt not real transmitter, and is 1/10 of the watt not real germanium receiver?
There's a man who periodically jams this particular repeater. He does it with 1 microwatt of power. If you've got the right resources of the right location, 1 microwatt is a substantial transmitter. It can create a hell of a lot of grief. There is no limit to how low a transmitter could be in power if you've got a sensitive enough receiver system with the right kind of a layout. So, is there a limit to how low you can use a transmitter? Not at all. Is there a limit to how low you can receive a signal? Not at all. So those are not calculatable. What I said was, in the way the problem was proposed, that you've got a transmitter, and how many dipole antennas can receive the signal? There is no limit. In the case of 8 billion miles of range, and I now make a spherical dish, I make a sphere with an 8 billion mile radius to it, and I now pepper the surface of that sphere with dipoles. I could call the number of dipoles I can put on that sphere, 8 billion miles in radius. I could call the number of dipoles an infinite number of dipoles. And I'm not that far wrong. I know that you wanted to ask a question, Bill. We put you off a few times. AC2IS, K2IS. AC2IS, K2IS. Go ahead, Bill.
Am I making the repeater?
You sure are, Bill. Go right ahead. You're a little bit low in audio, but you sound good.
Okay, so I almost bought a book today. As I was in line heading to the register, I picked up a few details in it. One of them was a claim that no radio and antenna combination could be more than 50% efficient. I was wondering what you thought of that. Another thing it said was that the dipole was actually, the two sides of the dipole were capacitively coupled. So this had something to do with all antennas and how they work. And then the third was, you guys were talking about fluorescent lights a lot, and you previously said something about there being no, possibly no electric field component in free space in a vacuum. And I was wondering if in that case you had a transmitter near a fluorescent light, would the fluorescent light up as a result of being near the transmitter or not? Back to you.
I'm going to go in reverse order. Many ham radio operators have put a fluorescent tube where the hand is in the middle of the fluorescent tube, not touching either end, and they've taken off the shielding of a, let's say, 80-meter transmitter running with an 807 tube, and they held the fluorescent tube a few inches away from the tank circuit of the transmitter, and the fluorescent tube lights up. Many a ham radio operator at VHF frequencies have transmitted, let me pick a number, 10 or 30 watts of power into a dipole, held a fluorescent tube parallel to the dipole, near the dipole, and lit up the fluorescent tube. Because the Q of the dipole antenna has got a Q of 20, and therefore whatever voltage the transmission line is launching into the dipole, the tips of the dipole at 20 times higher voltage, and that higher voltage capacitively coupled into the end of the fluorescent tube will light it. So can you transmit through free space into a fluorescent tube? Absolutely. Let me drop it. Because of the finite amount of energy and voltage that's required to ionize the gas in the fluorescent tube, usually the range is pretty small. Yeah, there was an experiment I saw once where a man was holding a fluorescent tube out in front of a phased array at the Goldstone location in the Mojave. No, that's in the at Fort Irwin, near the northern end of the Mojave Desert in California, near the Goldstone location, where they were doing experimenting with transmitting power on radio. They were using a very large dish antenna, a very large phased array to receive the signal roughly a mile away, and they were finding out how well they could transmit RF power. This was part of a proof-of-concept experiment to find out how easy it would be to build power satellites. I mean, there's been a number of proposals 20, 30 years ago where you're going to put huge solar arrays in space gathering solar energy. It's going to transmit into a whole bunch of magnetron tubes. Those magnetron tubes with a bunch of phased array antenna are going to be aiming the signal back down to, let's say, Arizona. A great big rectifying antenna covering a couple of square miles of Arizona was going to pick up the signal, and now you've got the equivalent of a solar panel that works at nighttime as long as you've got a synchronous satellite sending the signal down. Let me drop it. You go through the calculation of that system and you realize the number of dollars required to launch all that hardware in space and maintain all that hardware. And because you'd like to have continuous coverage over one spot over the United States, you'd like to be a synchronous satellite. Synchronous satellite is 22,000 miles away. No space shuttle has ever gone beyond 300 miles. How do you get up there 22,000 miles to do the repair? You don't. You look at the dollars, you look at the lack of repair, you look at the number of watts generated, you look at the number of watts received. Even if you put half the state of Arizona into a rectifying antenna, it's not a practical system. I'd much rather see them put a whole bunch of solar panels across Arizona, collect the power in the daytime, find some way of storing it so you can use it at nighttime. So solar power satellites are a great experiment on paper, a great thing to discuss. Very non-practical. I don't think we're ever going to see one. Now, how efficient can you make a transmitter? Let me drop. It's equivalent to saying, how efficient can I make a power supply? You allow me to use the right fast switching, very high on-off ratio, field effect transistors, I could build for you a power supply that runs at 97% efficiency. Of the raw power you put in at one voltage, I could give you a regulated output voltage at roughly 97% efficiency with regulation, even though you're putting in 97 to 160 volts in AC and getting out 29 volts DC output, if you know what I mean. You use the right kind of a switching network with the right kind of energy capture by way of the flyback of the transformer and whatever. You use the circuitry correctly that's available today, you can get extremely high efficiency. If I can build a switching regulator running at half a megacycle of switching rate, and I can make 97% efficiency out of it, that switching regulator could be sending its this half megacycle signal to an antenna instead of to a synchronous rectifier network that's part of the power supply. You give me enough resources, you give me the right materials, I could probably build for you a transmitter of 95% efficiency, Bill. In other words, of the raw power you put into it, 95% of it is being radiated by the antenna. Now, that's the good news. At any reasonable range, what percentage of that power you're going to get? Damn small. On many VHF, UHF frequencies, you get 90 decibels of loss in the first mile. That's the bad news. The good news is every time you double that range, you only lose 6 dB more power. So in my crazy example, you get 90 dB of loss in the first mile. You get 96 dB of loss total in the second mile. You get 102 dB of loss total in the first 4 miles. You keep doubling the mileage, if you know what I mean.
Repeater, timeout.
Each time I double the mileage, I only lose 6 more dB. And eventually that number starts really working in your favor. And so if I had a line of sight path of 100 miles, like from space shuttle to ground, and now in his orbit he moves 200 miles away from me, that signal only got 6 dB weaker. Double the mileage, if you know what I mean. So efficiency, and dipole. Is there capacitance at the end of the dipole? Absolutely. You know that normally when you cut the piece of wire for a dipole, electronically it's going to be a half wavelength long. Let me drop. Physically, you make the dipole 95% of that range, of that distance. Because the loop of wire at the end, the egg insulator at the end, those are all tip capacitance. So there's always a certain amount of stray capacitance at the end of the dipole. I could, in theory, build a dipole where I'm suspending it only from the center and I'm tapering it just right so it goes into a sharp point at the end and it's a hell of a lot fatter in the center. I could build a dipole where the physical length is extremely close to a half wavelength as opposed to this 95% jazz, if you know what I mean. I could minimize the capacitance at the end by mechanical construction techniques. The capacitance at the end is not bad. It's not an energy-absorbing device. A pure capacitor absorbs no continuous energy. That becomes extremely important when you use one of my particular puzzles. Let me drop. I'm disappointed to report that of all of the radio engineers that work for a particular company called Airborne Instruments Laboratory, and I must have hit about 30 of them with this puzzle, these guys are working for a company with almost every single product. It's got something to do with radio. And most of it's radar. Radar transmitters, receivers, antennas, rotary joints, modulators, demodulators, jammers, whatever. These are real radio people. And they ask him this fairly simple sounding puzzle. I've got an ideal piece of 50 ohm transmission line. And in the shielded box at the end, I've put a variable capacitor. And at my frequency of operation, I've carefully adjusted the capacitor at the end so the capacitor has exactly 50 ohms of capacitor reactance. So I got a 50 ohm transmitter terminated with a 50 ohm capacitor. and it's an ideal capacitor. The question is, what's the standing wave ratio? About two-thirds of those engineers will say it's 1-to-1. 50-ohm transmission line, 50-ohm termination. I then asked him the question, what percentage of the energy is being absorbed by that load? And they slowly, all of a sudden, you get a funny expression on their face, like tears and a deer in the headlights. You cannot continuously put energy into a capacitor, AC energy. Of all the energy that goes into that capacitor, if it's a good capacitor, 99.99% of it's going to reflect back to you. If the energy at the far end of the transmission line reflects back to you, the standing wave ratio is infinity, not 1-to-1. And so, the fact that you're tipsy with a dipole, let me drop. The fact that the tips of your dipole have a capacitor, don't worry about it. And if you want to mechanically shorten down the length of the dipole by putting top hat capacitors on the tips, a perfectly good thing to do, and that antenna can continue to have nearly 100% efficiency when you do it, even though it's smaller in size. Because you've made it smaller in size, the amount of energy that radiates down that wire as the signal travels down it the first time is a smaller percentage, because there's less wire there, therefore the Q of the antenna is going to be higher. It's going to be more narrowband. So putting capacitance at the end of your dipole makes it more narrowband, but it doesn't make it less efficient. I wonder if these are some of the questions you're looking, answers you're looking for, Bill. AC2IS, K2LIW on the deck, man.
AC2IS here. Thanks for taking my call. In regard to the capacitance question, this book made it sound like the capacitance is sort of a necessary part of having the antenna work in the first place. And this book, by the way, was called PCB Current Flow, How They Flow and How They React. I guess the they there stands for electrons. And it seemed very simply written, pretty good book. I was going to buy it, but when I got to the register, I found out it was going for $100. So I decided against it, but I was wondering if anybody had heard of it, and if so, what they thought of it.
Yeah, if you ask a whole bunch of people, how does a dipole work? A certain percentage of the population thinks that the current flowing, the high current near the center of the dipole creates a lot of magnetic field, and that begins the radiation process. A certain percentage of people say the high voltage at the tip of the dipole creates a strong E field, and that creates the radiation process. Another group of people will say it has just the right mixture of E field at the end and current at the center, and it makes an electromagnetic wave, a transverse electromagnetic wave. There are people who believe that. What's really going on with a dipole? You can start off with what you think is Maxwell's equations. You think it's going to give you an answer. I'm skeptical of that. It gives you some information. It doesn't give you engineering useful information in a form that you can go directly out there and know that a piece of 14-gauge wire, 137 feet long, 132 feet long, is going to be a good dipole at 3.7 megacycles. There's both simplicity and complication there in all situations. If you actually calculate the rate at which the electrons are flowing and how far they move on each half cycle of your dipole with a kilowatt of energy into it, I mean, during the positive half cycle, the electrons are moving to the left, so to speak, but they're only doing it for a fraction of a microsecond. How far did they get? How fast are they really moving, and how far did they get? You'll find out that what the electrons are doing is they're wiggling back and forth at 3.7 megacycle rate, but the amount of motion they do is micrometers at a kilowatt level. And you go down to the microwatt level, and you calculate how far the electrons are moving. It's an extremely small fraction of the radius of an atom. And how in the world can so little motion do so much action?
So, repeater, time out.
What's really going on at the atomic level with high amounts of electron flow? I mean, that other example that I've often used, 200 amperes is flowing out of your car battery on a cold morning to operate the starter motor. And that red electron coming out of the car battery, how long does that particular electron, on average, take to flow down that copper wire to get into the starter motor? And the answer is 4 hours. The electrons flowing in that battery stop and wiring problem is really a bunch of marbles in the pipe. And yes, within 3 nanoseconds, the red electron leaves the battery, and within 3 nanoseconds, another electron comes out of the far end of the wire and goes into the starter motor. It's not the same one. On average, that electron takes 4 hours at 200 ampere rate to get there. If Mother Nature would let you create the imbalance, you could drain the electrons out of that copper wire going to your starter matter. There's enough electrons there that you could drain those electrons at the 200 ampere rate for 4 solid hours. There's a lot of charge in that piece of copper. Mother Nature won't let you do that. You take one electron out of the far end, she says, I'm the bookkeeper, you're going to put one into the near end, or I'm going to stop the whole damn action on you. I know this is a little off the left of center, but maybe it helps a little bit. I'm not sure that that book is necessarily the one you want if you're trying to understand antenna theory, Bill. AT2IS, K2LIW. Questions? Bill first. Go ahead, Bill.
Thanks, Nick. Yeah, it was not specifically for radio stuff, but it did cover a lot of things like the example you're talking about, rate of propagation of electrons in a wire, things like that, and how to tune traces on a PC board for resonance or to avoid resonance.
Yeah, when it comes to printed circuit boards, in the real world, you put them on a shake table, and you're going to find out there's mechanical resonances that could give you grief, and you got to do fancy things to make sure the mechanical resonance is not going to create metallic fatigue and create open circuits and shake parts off your board. When it comes to radio resonance, the way you lay out your printed circuit board and the shielding you put it in, there's many a case where a guy has built a beautiful amplifier on a printed circuit board on a bench. It works like a charm. He puts it inside of a nice metal box to shield it from the rest of the world, and the thing breaks into oscillation because he didn't realize that the metal box has created a cavity resonator with the center conductor being the printed circuit board, and that transmission line with short circuits on each end inside the box, so to speak, has a cavity resonator at 721 megacycles, and his 100 megacycle transistorized amplifier just happens to have enough gain at 700 megacycles that it breaks into oscillation. So unshielded on the bench, the PC board is beautifully happy. You put it into a nice shielded box and all hell breaks loose. Now you've got to start doing mode killing techniques on the box to kill that particular resonance where your circuit gave you this undesirable response. That scenario has been repeated so damn many times, you wouldn't believe it. Wait for the beep and go ahead with your question, Wes. K2LIW.
Hey, Nick. N2XCN. When you were talking about the capacitor, were you talking about electric current moving charges, or you were talking about time varying electric fields? Were you then trying to explain dielectric polarization, or when you were talking about the atomic level, you were talking about superposition principle?
Maybe none of the above, maybe all of the above. If I'm putting an AC current through a capacitor, and I'm now studying at the atomic level what's happening. On the first half cycle of the AC current, I've got this capacitor connected across an inductor, the two are resonating, and I'm putting some energy in it at the resonant frequency. And on the first half cycle, I'm studying what's going on. I'm watching some electrons flow into one side of the capacitor. I'm watching some electrons flow out of the other side of the capacitor. The capacitor has a certain amount of capacitive reactance. That means it acts like it has a certain degree of connection between the left-hand lead and the right-hand lead. I can see current flowing in, I see current flowing out, but it's not the same electrons. Those electrons that go into the left-hand side put a negative charge on the left-hand plate. The negative charge on the left-hand plate creates a strong electrostatic field, which repels some of the electrons on the right-hand plate, and those electrons on the right-hand plate leave and come out of the right-hand wire. As a black box, it confuses the hell out of me. I watch current flowing in, I watch current flowing out, and I can easily make the assumption it's the exact same electrons. Not one single electron flows through that capacitor if there was no leakage resistor. If there's a leakage resistor across the plates, yes, some real current flows through. But other than that, it's reactive current flowing through. It looks like it flows through. By all measurements you make on the outside of this thing as a black box, you think it's the same electrons going in and coming out. It ain't the same electrons. That's all I'm saying. Now, there's various ways that you can use all of the theories we've heard up till now to explain that. I'm getting down to the atomic level of the electrons going in that piece of wire, going up to that left-hand plate of the capacitor, and some electrons leave the right-hand plate of the capacitor and go down the right-hand wire. That's what I'm sort of getting into.
Repeater, timeout.
That's what I'm sort of getting into because, from my point of view, it explains a little bit about what's taking place. And as you can tell, at first, it's not common sense. If you want to call that displacement current, you can. I think we're way beyond the point where we should have gone to the mailbag. What do you think, John? KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
And that was the mailbag, Dick. That was from the mailbag. Pick up Eric.
You've got it, Eric. Okay, a whole lot of dropouts. What is a dBm of 2.5 kilowatts? 1 kilowatt is plus 60 dBm. 2 kilowatts would be plus 63 dBm. 2.5 kilowatts, it can't be around 64 or 65 dBm. Is that what you're sort of asking, Eric? Go ahead.
Thank you. I'm wondering if I'm transmitting. I've got to figure out how much of a directional couple ID. Thank you. That's all I wanted to know. K2RWK2J. I'm way out in New Jersey.
With all the radars that I've ever worked with, Eric, usually the peak pulse power is around a megawatt. A megawatt of peak pulse power going into the antenna. A nice round number. A megawatt is plus 90 dBm. I've worked on a radar that has power output from the antenna of plus 120 dBm. Don't want to stand close to that one. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, actually, you've got it right. There is no electric current of moving charges. However, there is no reactive current. It is a time-varying electric field. That's what is being called displacement current. Do you agree with that?
The average engineer will talk about the capacitive reactance of a capacitor, 1 over 2 pi square root of L, 1 over 2 pi, 1 over 2 pi FC. By that equation, you know the amount of capacitive reactance, in other words, the amount of connection you seem to have between the left-hand lead and the right-hand lead of the capacitor at that particular frequency. It has that degree of connection. We call it ohms of capacitive reactance. We call it capacitive reactance because if you put a dual trace oscilloscope on it where one probe is measuring current and one probe is measuring voltage, you will always see exactly 90 degrees of difference between the phase angle of the current and the phase angle of the voltage, with the current being leading by 90 degrees compared to the voltage. So we call that capacitive reactance, but the amount of connection we call ohms, as if there was a resistor there, but it's a crazy resistor that always gives 90 degrees of phase shift on a capacitor in the leading manner, and on an inductor it's 90 degrees of lag. So you could use all kinds of words to describe that, and you could try to relate that back to the Maxwell's equations, but the real engineers, on a day-to-day basis, calculate capacitor reactance, calculate voltage, therefore calculate how much current is going to flow through it, and at what phase angle. That's the real world. OUS K2LIW.
Having derivation from the Ampere's law, that's what I think it is. We're talking about day-to-day physics. But the problem of Ampere was that he didn't leave the room for the time-varying electric current. In other words, he was operating with the BOH magnetic field. He was in with him magnetostatics, but the reason that Maxwell was thinking about it, which was quite a time after
after the amper was because when you etch time factor in it, actually you have a full explanation of what's going on in the capacitor. Otherwise, if we take that loop that I was talking about, the loop that is cut in one place and has two plates on it, and we straight it out, we'll have a very hard time to explain what you're talking about. So that's why I say, yes, it is no electric current or moving charges that's ever taking place. Enter a tree.
Very few hams have done it, but I think there was at least one that wrote an article in 73 magazine where he took a 6-meter hula hoop antenna, separated the two plates of the capacitor, took the loop itself and straightened it out, and proved that it was a dipole antenna. Instead of operating at 6 meters, it now operated closer to 2 meters. So it went up in frequency because the amount of picofarads of capacitance at the end decreased because he made a great big separation between the two plates. So you can take that hula hoop antenna, you can very slowly expand the spacing between the two capacitor plates. You'll watch the frequency continuously go up as you do it, and as the loop of wire, so to speak, of the loop of the hula hoop antenna becomes straight out and flat and linear, you now have slowly moved from a loop antenna to a dipole antenna. At no point did it stop operating. It just slowly shifted up in frequency, and the antenna pattern that used to be omnidirectional started slowly sliding into a dipole pattern. There was no magic for the spacing between the plates. There was no magic for a particular length of the wire between the two plates. There was no magic for whether they're curved around in a circle or out straight. It's all the same kind of an antenna. In all cases, let me drop. In all cases, there is a significant amount of energy bouncing back and forth between the two halves of the dipole, so to speak, or you could say between the left-hand side capacitor plate and the right-hand side capacitor plate. Energy is bouncing back and forth 20 times before it gets radiated. And whether you want that energy to move through a circular loop of a hula hoop antenna or a straight piece of wire of a dipole antenna is your choice. The method by which it radiates is fairly similar. The pattern changes slowly. The frequency changes slowly. There is no magic in that whole process from the average amateur radio operator's point of view when he does that experiment in his backyard. And at least one guy did that experiment and reported it in 73 magazine. There's no magic there. OUS, K2LIW. Good, and we have given all kinds of arguments on that one. But what's the easiest way that a person can pose questions to the chat room, John, which apparently you're watching, thank goodness, and that way they can get questions to us during the net and say, hey, Dick and John just used these particular words. What do they mean? KC2WGB, KQLIW in the tech net.
Yes, Dick, I watch the chat room during the net all of the time, and when the questions come up, I do bring them. Okay, it's www.chatzy.com. That's the information I have. If Lou is listening and there's an error there, maybe he could correct that. But it's Chatzy, C-H-A-T-Z-Y. And that'll bring him into this chat room. And we have quite a few visitors here and there. Some of them have questions. Some of them are just comments about how much they're enjoying it. So back to you, Dick.
So have we used up all of the questions of the chat room today and all of the snail mails and emails that you've received for the mailbag? Have we used up all of those questions, John? And when I pass it back to you, I'm going to give a nice long pause before you pick up. So if anyone out of the area wants to sign in, they'll have an opportunity to do it. KC2WGB, with some delay. KQLIW in the second half.
Yeah, there's NY2H. That's part of the address. After that comes a slash and a string of digits. Stand by. Let me let it drop. I'll give you the full address. All right, www.chatzy.com. That's Charlie Hotel Alpha Tango Zulu Yankee. www.chatzy.com/2232 2590 485098. I'm going to repeat that. www.chatzy.com/2232 2590 485098 NY2H.
Wow. That's a biggie. As a dinosaur, I got one hell of a question for you, as I see it, Lou. Obviously, multiple guys have signed into the chat room, and that great big moniker, that great big IRL, URL, hasn't been announced on the TechNet itself very often. These guys that are really savvy, how did they find that out? What is the process by which they found the chat room? Because that great big number wasn't announced on the TechNet, to my knowledge, at any time in the last year or so. So how did these guys find this? What magic did they use, Lou? NY2H, KQLIW?
I did announce it twice, Dick.
Okay, but how did the average guy find it, Lou?
All right, in addition to John announcing it a couple of times, it's on the LIMOC website. So if they had gone to the LIMOC website, they would see a link, including the full address of the chat room.
Okay, now that people know how to get there, hopefully that'll work. So that's the chat room.
Unfortunately, we have a long URL like that because it's a free service, so you got to take what they give you.
Is there a way of asking for a compact URL that would be the equivalent?
You know, we could probably do one of those tiny URLs. That's an idea, where we'd have a shorter substitute. It has nothing to do with the chat room people themselves. It'll just be a relay to it. Good idea. I'll look into that. Maybe we'll have one for you. But it'll be shorter.
And therefore easier to memorize. This one, in my opinion, is not very easy to memorize. Almost impossible. You can easily transpose some of those numbers and get it wrong. And if you just put in chatzy.com, would that give you a hint as to which one do you want to go to? Or would that get you absolutely nowhere, Rulu? NY2H, KQLIW?
I just did it now, and it's basically if you want to start your own chat room, you go to kind of the homepage, I guess. Let's just verify that. Yeah, and I don't see any kind of, let's see, hosted rooms, if they have any kind of, no. I don't see any kind of index, you know, or table of contents, or, you know, these rooms that are currently available. I do see something that says my rooms, but that's for registered users only. What it is they have an upsell. It's a free, you know, initial boilerplated free thing, but if you want some of the extras, and probably one of the extras is a reasonable address, they want money. And it seems pretty dear. I think it's like 50 cents a day or something ridiculous. So, but anyway. And we have this one. We had another one. And then they stopped servicing, so we went to this one.
Hey, Lou, where are you located? You are potent on my input. Over to you, Lou.
Yeah, I'm at home, Port Jeff Station.
Wow. How in the world are you that strong on my input? Okay, I just realized. I'm using an antenna at the top of the tower that's aimed in the wrong direction, and it favors you. Okay. John, you want to add something? And let's give a nice long delay in case anyone else wants to sign in. KT2WGB with a delay. K2RIW and Techman.
KC2WGV. Yeah, quick comment, Dick, and Luke, correct me if I'm wrong. I just got a little note here that if they go to the Limark site, not only is it listed, there's a link there. You can click on it, and I believe that'll take them right to it. KC2WGV, back to you, Dick.
There might be the equivalent of a tiny URL there already. Okay, if we've gone to the mailbag, I think it's time to go to the SpaceNet. Paul, WS2N, choose whichever way you want to get in, and what has NASA been doing this week? And make sure that they keep funding that James Webb Space Telescope. I'm intentionally getting lots of exercise, eating lots of vegetables and grains and fruit, and not eating bad food, getting lots of rest. I want to make sure I'm in good, healthy shape when James Webb gets launched in 2018, because I think great things are coming. I'm only half kidding when I say these things, Paul. WS2N, K2LIW, the TechNet.
Okay, Dick. WS2N. Well, you know, no matter how long you live, there's going to be launches that are going to outflip everybody. Like, there's something that just went on the drawing board now by the European Space Agency called JUICE. And the Jupiter Ice Moon Explorer. And that's going to launch in, it's going to launch in 2022. That's the launch date, so they're just going to start developing this now. And they'll launch from French Guiana on a Ariane 5 rocket, and it'll hit the Jupiter. Won't get the Jupiter, Dick, get this until 2030. So, you know, it's got probably a little over 6-year flight to get there. And then it'll orbit. The idea is to look at all the moons, you know, out of the four Galileo moons. You got Io and Calypso and Europa and Ganymede, you know, the three of them, except for Io, I believe, have lots of water underneath the ice. So, what's going to happen is Juice has plans on 32 actually going into orbit around Ganymede, so it's going to be hard to have all these up and coming launches. No matter how old you are, you're going to catch you sooner or later, Dick. Wanted to mention a couple of things. First of all, how am I making the repeat of that?
Rather well, Paul. Please proceed.
Okay, there's a launch coming up in Japan. Usually I don't follow all these foreign ones, but this one, they're in partnership with NASA. set of equipment on board, and it's called a Global Precipitation Measurement Core. And Japan's going to launch it this week on the 27th. And the idea is to measure every bit of raindrop and snowfall and you name it that comes out of the clouds on the whole planet. Precise measurements. They want to know exactly, you know, what's coming down from the clouds, you know, for environmental purposes. So I thought I'd mention that. Japan and NASA have teamed up together to launch, make that launch. They have a launch facility in Tangashimiya, Japan. So I'll probably see that on a computer or something. Naturally, that won't be on TV. I did want to mention Curiosity. Anybody that goes to the NASA website probably has saw the story about Curiosity driving backwards. It went over 300 feet backwards the other day. And the record is roughly around 600 feet in the forward direction. They wanted to run this thing in the backward direction because... they have problems with their wheels. We've talked about this in the past. A lot of rough rocks, tons of crap. Well, it doesn't weigh 2 tons on Mars, but it's heavy. It's probably about 5 times heavier than Opportunity or Spirit. Damaging the wheels, creating a lot of dents and things, minor holes. Wheels. So to avoid that, they're taking better routes, trying to go on more sandy areas, taking better pictures with the high-rise camera on board, the Mars Global Surveyor. That could, you know, if you had a table, put the table, put it on Mars, the high-rise could take a picture of that. Resolution for that good. So, they're plotting better course. And one of the things they want to be able to do is have this thing be able to sneak big. It might help save some of the wear and tear in certain locations. Ultimate goal is to go out to Mount Sharp, which is coming up in probably late May, maybe June. They have quite a bit more to go. They've got about 3.5, 4 miles to make it to Mount Sharp. The odometer I think they've gone about 3.5 miles, and now they have about to make it to Mount Sharp. They're far from the record. Opportunity is a record for miles, but it's been on Mars over 10 years now, and it's almost 25 miles. But it sets the all-time record for any off-road vehicle on a different planet. Well, planet or moon is the Russian. They have a record of 27 miles back with their lunar cars landing back in the 70s. And Opportunity will, I'm going to get beat that record probably within another year or so. So, I think that was a good idea sending 2 spacecraft last time, Spirit and Opportunity, because Spirit has quit back in 2010 around March, and Opportunity is still going. I would have liked to see them do that, but Curiosity, but they didn't. Good news is they have another flight coming up probably in 2020, very similar to Curiosity, except with more sophisticated instruments on board. It'll probably be the same type of launch, the same type of a landing with the rocket crane system that we used last time, a little over a year ago for Curiosity. And one other thing I wanted to bring up. you know, comments and questions. The TV show coming up in March, it's going to be called Cosmos Space Time Odyssey. And what it is, a lot of people, hundreds of millions of people have watched Carl Sagan's Cosmos show back in 1980. And it was a 13-part series. I remember going to the library and getting the tapes and watching it again years ago. You watch the things and you wish you had it for a permanent video library. Probably the best 13 hours in space universe type of lecture you could possibly ever sit through. I remember on this net many times the past couple of years talking about who's going to replace Carl Sagan. And this guy was not only a spokesman for people in the States, worldwide, the show Cosmos has probably been seen through over 100 countries and nationally translated. And I remember saying, I bet this guy Neil DeGrasse Tyson, you know, this guy was, he really picked up the spot, comes from New York, comes out of the Bronx, and is involved with the Hayden Planetarium. Many PBS shows. And sure enough, he's going to pick up the slack. He's going to do the next 13-part series with the approval of Ann Doran. Ann Doran is Carl Sagan's wife. Apparently, she must have some rights to the Cosmos show. She's approving this guy to pick up the reins. That should be pretty good, Dick. And that's pretty much it for the space portion of the net. If anybody wants to comment, questions, you can always contact me on spacenetreport.gmail.com. Dick, over you, KQRIW, TechNet, WSN.
Question, Dick.
Go ahead, John. And John, give a little bit of delay in case someone else also wants to sign in.
KC2WGB. A question for Paul is, what information does he have about the failure of the Chinese rover, if he has any? KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
You got a call.
Okay, did it fail? A couple of weeks ago, it was still riding around. What happened there, John? I haven't heard anything. I'll look it up.
Okay, I thought you might know. I know it's supposed to go into its sleep mode again. This would be the third one, I believe. But there's a traveling... It doesn't seem to be able to move. And I thought maybe you'd have information on that. What the problem is, I don't know. But I heard that yesterday, I believe.
Who is that?
NTXGN. Paul, did you have a chance to view that material about plasma ribbon conforms electric sun from the space news? John was able to see that video, so if you didn't, he would be able to reserve.
No, Wesley, the last one I watched was the cyclotron. Was that lady explaining everything about the cyclotron? Very good topic. I've seen the email, but I haven't had a chance to view that. But I will. John, okay, on the Jade Rabbit, they call that, trotting around on the moon. They did pretty good, you know. I mean, think about it. Well, they take a lot of, they've learned a lot from what we've done, what the Soviets have done. You know, in one shot to the moon, they have put a spacecraft in orbit around the moon. But I mean, for their first attempted landing, putting a robot on, riding around with